This is the La Carre Cast. Hello and welcome to La Carre Cast. My name's Jeff and I'm your host. Each episode, we take a deeper dive into all things La Carre. We're back this week to discuss some of the things we learned about his novels from the letters of John Le Carre. So continuing to join me on this journey is Matthew Bradford. Matthew, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me back. I love discussing Le Carre.
We've talked about kind of the things we learned about in his personal life and things that we learned about his professional life. Now we come to some things we learned about the novels that he did. And I'm excited to dive into this because I feel like there were some significant things that we learned as we read through the letters about how he wrote his books and some of the things that went into his writing. And, you know, I'm just going to jump right in there because one of the first things that we get, which I really loved, is we have Le Carre drawing, because one of the things that we learn, right, especially through the Sisman book, but also in this, is that Le Carre loved to draw. And he really wanted to make his impression as an artist. He did book covers. He did drawings for Talking Animals. Is that it? Which was the book from Maxwell Knight.
He did some Talking Animal illustrations for Maxwell Knight, who's often, you know, called a model for M. I don't think he ever was for Fleming's M, but the title of the biography of Maxwell Knight is The Man Who Was M, The Life of Maxwell Knight, because he was an MI5 spymaster, and that's an easy shorthand, even when you're talking about a different service. But fascinating guy, whether or not he
really
was
really
weird a
guy.
Model for
guy
M.
He had a bear and in his apartment, you know, like he was a crazy, crazy dude.
But I think he was actually something of a mentor to Le Carre, not to the extent that Bingham was, but in agent handling to some degree. Like, I don't remember if this is something I'm recalling from a letter. I think it's actually from either Sisman or the Pigeon Tunnel, which is out of the purview of what we're discussing right now and not something I have notes on. So I could be completely wrong, but I'm recalling something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think so. Well, and they obviously had a connection. I mean, Le Carre was drawing for his books. So there was definitely a connection there. But the drawing, and specifically I'm thinking of, was of John Bingham, who did a sketch, there's this sketch of John Bingham in the letters that is basically, it's really like a sketch of Smiley, right? I mean, when you look at the sketch, you're like, oh, wait, that's what he thought of Smiley looking like, right? I think this is on, at least in the edition I have, I think I'm looking at the UK edition. It's on page 90 or so.
This particular illustration, yeah, totally. That is Smiley, but of course it's John Bingham. But I think that's very much who he had in his mind, even though, as we know, it was really a combination of Bingham and Vivian Green, who there's also plenty of letters from. Also in his illustrations, there was the Downhill magazine stuff. Like the whole downhill skiing aspect was, I think it came more clearly to me in this book than any of the other biographies, because Sisman touched on it, but didn't get into as much detail about it as here. But not only was he regularly doing cover illustrations and drawings for the Downhill Ski Journal or something like that, but he had like really considered a career as a downhill skier. You know, we get that out of his letters to Anne. And then later on, of course, as we talked about before, we get that he wrote a script for his sons to produce, a script in the 80s, I believe, but based on the sort of 1950s world of downhill skiing that he lamented the loss of, because it was all different with the kind of equipment and stuff that was used in the 80s. But I mean, there's a lot of letters alluding to his illustrations and his illustration deadline for Downhill magazine or Downhill Journal, whatever it was.
Yeah. No, I thought that was really interesting as well. One of the other things I really appreciated was we get this, you know, Richard Hutt, who I talked to about his map, you know, the Le Carre's London, John Le Carre's London, must have loved this bit where he's just kind of going on and on with Gollin's lawyer about specific locations in Call for the Dead that are, you know, like, oh, well, this is really there, or this is, you know, we could change this name if it's a little too close. That was like catnip to me, like, oh, well, this is the exact place you were talking about? Okay. Because like he really, it really gave you the sense that, okay, he was pulling from reality. And that was pretty obvious early on, but even more so, you see it just hammered home in this, right?
And I actually pulled out that map because, I mean, yeah, it's probably too bad for him that this book of letters came out after he had made that, but it was a good reference to have reading that letter because I don't have a good geographic knowledge of London. So the map was a helpful visual resource.
Yeah, well, and he's talking about like the specific theaters and specific pubs and all of that stuff that I thought was really, really cool. So he's obviously been walking London and really trying to think about how can I use that in my novel.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, it makes me think, you know, obviously for him, I think that was more so early on. And so that makes me think about his development as a novelist, right? Because I do think that there's a certain amount of that that happens, right? For a first-time novelist, you really are pulling from reality to help build that world. And you can see that later on in his writing too, that he's less concerned about playing into the reality of a place. I mean, you look at Legacy of Spies, where he gives you very little sense of the real places that he was using, or Agent Running in the Field, where it's much more diffuse about like the reality of the places that he's doing, right?
Well, yeah, but there is a letter about that specifically, too, where, and I don't have this one marked because I wasn't planning to bring this one up, but he talks about when he's no longer going to visit locations. Because I think, so going back, we have here in this letter you're talking about an example of, you know, the London locations that he knows and that he's writing about, because he starts out writing about the places he knows, and then he sort of expands his field in his books, but he's still writing largely about places that he's been in his life, like Germany. You know, when he gets out of London, he's getting to Germany, where obviously he had served and got, you know, knew from trips when he was at school in Switzerland or whatever. Oh, I guess he couldn't go to Germany then, but knew from his military service and his MI6 service there. Then when he gets further afield, like, I mean, even then, Tinker Tailor doesn't really leave London. You know, there's some mentions of Checo, but we don't need to know. And he probably had been there, you know, but we didn't need to know very detailed specifics. But then, Checo's the miniseries, the book, what was the location? Oh, it's also in the book, yeah. But then when you get to Honorable Schoolboy, that's when it really changes. And he's talking about the Far East, where he hadn't been. So he went on the first of his elaborate reconnaissance trips before writing the book. And there's several letters here that are really great about that, of first trying to find good guides to take him to these war zones, essentially, because this is while fighting is going on and he's touring the area. And then, you know, about how much he learns there. And then he goes on a major trip for the little drummer girl as well. And there's a lot of letters, whole lot of letters about that, and about one of his guides in particular, who then shortly after showing him was killed in a bomb, I believe. But then, after going to Africa for the Constant Gardener, which I think also gave him the germ of the Mission Song, he knew he was going to write about the Congo and Mission Song, but he hadn't actually traveled there. And there's a letter where he talks about, basically, he's trying to make a trip to the Congo, but it's too dangerous to go. So he's getting someone to fill in for him some local details. He has, you know, a contact on the ground there who's giving him some details. And then he writes a letter about how he's not going to take these trips because it's taking its toll on him. By now, he's in his late 60s, early 70s, probably, and it's just maybe even mid-70s by that point. Tough to make that kind of trip. So he said, okay, from now on, I'm no longer doing these elaborate travels for research, and I'm going to write about what I know about. So I think that's when you get what you're talking about in Legacy of Spies. You get less details on it because it's not a priority to him anymore. And I wish I had this particular letter bookmarked. As I say, I don't remember who it was to, but he does say, I'm done. I'm done with the trips. But he was still able to recycle some of his trip to Russia for the Russia House. He got a lot of ground out of and was able to use for Single and Single and Absolute Friends, where another one that he never got to make his trip with. He was hoping to go into the English regions for Absolute Friends. I hope I'm saying that right. But what wasn't able to, but that gangster character that he had met, which he talks about more in Pigeon Tunnel than any letters here, but certainly not only formed, you know, characters in both Single and Single and Absolute Friends, but then Dima in Our Kind of Traitor years later. So I think after he retired from traveling for research journeys, he was still picking other things, details that he hadn't used yet from his past trips. I mean, the guy made a lot of trips, you know, he had a lot to draw from even without making new research journeys, right?
Yeah, I mean, he knew how to kind of finesse that and find ways to use his past travels to try and keep going with it, new stories for sure.
Yeah.
So I've got to ask you now, I know you're a big Bond fan, and we get the letter that Le Carre has here to the Soviet Literary Gazette, where he kind of lays in to James Bond. For those reading along, I think that's on page 155 of the UK edition. I don't know where it is on the US one. But, you know, especially that last paragraph, he just kind of goes in there. He says here, he is the hyena who stalks the capitalist deserts. He is an identifiable antagonist, sustained in capital and kept in good heart by the charms of a materialistic society. He is a chauvinist, an unblinking patriot who makes espionage exciting, the kind of person, in fact, who emerges from Lonsdale's diaries. Bond on his magic carpet takes us away from the moral doubt, banishes perplexity with action, morality with duty. Above all, he has the one piece of equipment without which not even his formula would work, an entirely evil enemy. He is on your side, not mine. What did you think of that? He's like, you know, both barrels, anti-James Bond.
Yeah, and listen, this is, of course, sir, because this was published. This was a published letter and serves as one of the sort of ongoing cultural points in terms of talking about Le Carre as hating James Bond.
Well, he's pretty, you know, it's a pretty good point in saying that he hates him.
Well, except that, I mean, you read the last paragraph of the letter. So the whole point of the letter is actually that he's annoyed by a piece that's been published behind the Iron Curtain criticizing his book, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and The Looking Glass War. And he feels that he was dealing with criticizing the Western espionage apparatus, and then this review comes out in a Russian publication basically saying that he's glorifying it, and so he's very unhappy with that. So he brings Bond in as a stalking horse. Essentially, he wants to say, I'm not doing that, this is what does that. So he's coming at it like he has an agenda here that isn't going after Fleming. I mean, he's gone after Fleming before, which is very interesting, because as we talked about in another point, you know, while he acknowledges in these letters the debt that he owes to Graham Greene for his quote on The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, but none of the letters acknowledge any debt to Ian Fleming, who also had a blurb on the back of the Pan paperback edition that very complimentary of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. And, you know, that was from their, I'm guessing their best-selling author, Pan's best-selling author at the time. And it stayed on every paperback edition, Pan in England, for years and years. So that had to have a huge part too. But I've never seen Le Carre acknowledge that. So I'd be interested to know how he felt about that. Because yeah, obviously he was going after Bond in the way that any, you know, so did Dayton, so did John Gardner, who would later go on to write Bond books. But it's the biggest bully in the prison yard, you know, and the one that you want to go and beat up to make your name, you know, to show. And this letter then is a little bit different from that. It's not about publishing. It's about, it's funny because we've talked before about how he gets really riled up by critics, you know, like
he does not like critics. Does not.
for a best-selling author, I mean, you would expect some of them to get a little thicker skin about that. Cause over the, I mean, you know, you might, at a certain point, you'd think you'd just be like, yeah, you might not have liked it, but I'm cashing the checks, you know, like, but no, it continues to bother him throughout his career when he gets any negative reviews.
Well, and he never forgets the bad reviews that he gets in the past. Like, he's like stews about them. You see that over and over again
from
stuff he writes.
Absolutely. in both Pigeon Tunnel and in these letters here. And of course, as we've talked about before, he ends friendships over criticisms of his work too. So anyway, I think that's his big beef in this letter is actually with this Soviet critic who is basically lumping him in with Fleming, you know, as a imperialist Western propagandist. And he wants to point out that he's different. While at the same time, so in the letter, he's trying to have his cake and eat it too, because he's saying that he criticizes the Western services, but he's also not trying to align himself with the Soviet Union. He's just surprised at what this critic has chosen to take issue with, because he doesn't see himself. So that's when he's talking about Bond as the hyena who stalks the capitalist deserts, that is what he doesn't do. And he seems to feel, you guys should love me because I'm not doing that. Yet at the same time, he's also not embracing their way, you know? So I think he wants to have his cake and eat it too in this letter. Well, get a little more context. So in the Looking Glass War, to which he also refers, he being this critic Voinov, I tried to deal with a different aspect of the same Western predicament. The ideological deadlock, which provided the background to the spy who came in from the cold, is replaced by the psychological deadlock of men whose emotional experiences are drawn from an old war. The piping is stopped, but they still dance. I tried to touch on new ground when I discussed the phenomenon of committed men who are committed to nothing but one another and the dreams they collectively evoke. Because I chose a Western intelligence service as a vehicle for these ideas, do not think, I beg you, that I consider they do not apply elsewhere. I mention this because I have heard rumors that the Looking Glass War may, after all, be published in the Soviet Union. So, you know, he actually, even writing this letter, he's still hoping for publication behind the Iron Curtain, you know. And he says, I now realize that both these books make an assumption which is anathema to a communist and directly contrary to the trend now established by the public relations team of the Soviet secret services, that the enemy is not outside us, but within, that we fight not looking forward, but looking back, not for the future, but for the past. The problem of the Cold War is that, as Auden once wrote, we haunt a ruined century. Behind the little flags we wave, there are old faces weeping and children mutilated by the fatuous conflicts of preachers. Mr. Voinov, I suspect, smelt in my writing the greatest heresy of all, that there is no victory and no virtue in the Cold War, only a condition of human illness and political misery. And so he called me its apologist. He might as well have called Freud a lecher. Which, I mean, that last sentence is particularly apt, you know, comparing himself to Freud there in terms of, like, you're blaming the psychiatrist for the condition he's treating. You know, that's how he sees himself. Like, this letter is actually very interesting in terms of how he views his writing and the Cold War. To me, I mean, that's only a condition of human illness and political misery. You know, that's really the essence of Le Carré's view of what the Cold War has done to both sides. But yeah, he seems surprised that the Soviet critics wouldn't like that, you know, but of course, they don't want to see admit any folly within themselves and their side as well. So you can see why they'd be against it.
It's also one of those things where it's like, you know, for a writer, he's just doing the ABCs, right? Always be closing. Always try and get your work published someplace else. That's the yeah. The writer's, the biggest writer's goal, right?
Yeah, for sure. But so Bond, he says, basically, look, I'm not that. You know, you might think that I'm bad, but I'm not that. You know, that's the real emblem of the Western chauvinism. Later, years later, he actually, this was quoted to him in an NPR interview that I wish I had a transcript of, but I don't. And he recanted a bit. He sort of laughs and says, maybe I was a little harsh on James Bond back then, but no one ever quotes that. You know, they always still trot out his sort of diatribes against Fleming and Bond.
Well, you know, moving on, we saw some really fascinating insights onto a small town in Germany in this letter to C.P. Snow. You know, he talks about how the book took me 2.5 years and I wrote it 3 times, once with a narrator, once without a Leo figure at all. Turner was an embassy official, and finally the form in which you read it. And I thought that was really interesting and kind of thinking about that book, which, you know, we've talked about on the podcast before. I did a two-parter on A Small Town, and I can see how he struggled with that, because you get the sense of that in the final product. And Leo is the huge crux of that book, and you still feel like when you get to the end of that book, he didn't quite crack it, right? I mean, he took three passes, and he still didn't quite figure it out.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I do like the book quite a lot, but you're right. There's something, it feels like it didn't quite get where he wanted it to be. And it is interesting, but also not terribly surprising to learn this. But then, of course, we also learn about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which I think is a complete masterpiece that he threw out an earlier draft or burned it, although we get some more insight into that legend. But yeah, and then it's interesting to me as a screenwriter to think that he then did more drafts after he'd finished, you know, done three completely different drafts of that as a book. Other letters allude to how he spent a long time writing that for Sidney Pollack, writing different drafts, trying to crack A Small Town in Germany movie. So how long was he totally reworking this story for? It was years, you know. Yeah. Like he wrote it again and again as a book, and then he wrote it again and again as a film script that never got realized. Yeah, I wonder if he was ever happy with any versions. Probably not.
What I would say is with the screenplay, I think there's this thing, Works in Progress, which I read a little bit of at the start of part two of our look at A Small Town in Germany, where he really dives into the character of Leo. He really explores that character. And I think he finally kind of got, like, I need to show Leo. Like, not showing Leo in A Small Town in Germany was a mistake.
Right.
And so, but he really started to play with that some more. And I think so he was getting a lot closer. So I really would be curious to read that Small Town in Germany screenplay, because I think it might have been closer to something that I would have liked to have seen in the novel.
Yeah, me too. I would kill, as we said in another episode, I would love to read any of the scripts that he talks about, but especially that one, because it was rewriting. And, you know, he talks about that too in his introduction to the published version of his script, A Murder of Quality, where he did actually get that script made years, you know, 30 years after he wrote the book. They made the TV movie and he wrote the script for it. And in his introduction, he writes about how he sort of was fixing the problems that he'd always had with it that were bothering him over the years and that bothered him specifically on rereading it. I mean, my personal opinion was that actually it was better in the book. You know, I think the changes he made were not for the better in the years later TV script. But it's clear that that's how he saw these scripts that he worked on. So yeah, it would be fascinating. I feel like it's actually sort of a missing part, as dare I call us Le Carre scholars, you know, like we're missing that chunk, you know, of what he saw as a sort of continued version of these books, writing these scripts. Oh man, I hope that at some point the state publishes those. That would be amazing.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. If not, you know, it's a reason why to go to the Bodleian Library, right? And check that stuff out.
Yeah.
Because, like, not only that, but there was recently revealed that the reason The Night Manager season 2 didn't happen a lot sooner was they had this writer's room that came up with concepts for it. And Le Carre kind of spiked them and said, you know what, these are really great, but not what I would do. And here's what I would do, and kind of spun those ideas out. So I'd love to get a look at whatever that was, because that's really fascinating.
For sure. And of course, you wonder now that they are doing this moving forward with it, how much of it is, did they just ignore that and move forward with what they were planning to do originally? Like, okay, he's not around anymore. We can do what we were going to do. Or did they take that into consideration and they're doing the things that he would have done,
or spinning off in some completely different direction from either of those? Yeah,
but I do want to jump back to James Bond for a second, because that's another interesting thing in this book. We get it sort of highlights, like, what's evident when you look at the filmography of John le Carre's novels. He's had two Bond actors star in movies, and the wife of a future Bond actor, but that's just a coincidence. He had Sean Connery in The Russia House, and he's very complimentary of him in the letters in the book here. And then he had Pierce Brosnan in The Tailor of Panama, and he was really over the moon about Brosnan in these. So I think that's another reason that he may have softened on Bond over the years a bit, because he also got to cash in further. You know, I mean, he already the success of some of his books. You know, I don't think you have the success of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold if it weren't reacting to something that already exists as a bestseller. But then in the movies, he writes, he spent a day in Ojai with Pierce Brosnan before they did the Tale of Panama, and it seems to have gone really well based on the short letter we get that he sent to Pierce. After our day in Ojai, I was certain that the casting was inspired, and I believe the world will see a PB they haven't dreamed of. All good things, have a ball, and my love to you and yours, Damon. And then later he told John Borman, after he saw Brosnan's performance, he said, Pierce's excellent acting and range do make it his movie. It's Pierce's hair to Jeffrey's tortoise, and they're both wonderful, but he found himself living more in Osnard's part. So, I mean, clearly he was very happy with Brosnan's performance there. And while he doesn't reference Bond there, I think it's clear that the Brosnan performance in that movie, made while he was the Bond of note between Bond movies, is very much drawing on his Bond persona because it's a reaction to it. You know, it's almost, I'd say the movie is almost more of a direct criticism of James Bond than any of Le Carré's novels are, because Osnard in the book is not really a Bond type. You know, he's and the movie, it gets the book's Osnard, but it also makes him such a critique of James Bond, especially that Pierce Brosnan is so good in it. Like, you realize how Brosnan really excels when he's playing sleazier characters, but that also, of course, makes you think of the sleazier aspects of the Bond character.
Yeah.
And I think that that movie may be this kind of harshest critique that Le Carré is associated with of James Bond, coming from the actor who embodied Bond at that time.
Yeah. It's really interesting to think about the way that he looked at his characters after seeing them in film, you know, because there's this really nice letter to Alec Guinness where he gives so much insight into Smiley. Like, I was amazed. It was like a revelation a little bit into what he thinks about that character. One of the things he says is, his authority springs from experience, ages of it, compassion, and at root, an inconsolable pessimism, which gives a certain fatalism to much that he does. And it kept going. I was like, wow, this is really fascinating insights into what he thinks about Smiley in a way that we don't get anywhere else, I don't think. I don't recall him really just diving into what Smiley meant to him and what his view on Smiley was, right? Do you agree?
Yeah, that was amazing. That letter was really fantastic. I mean, we get some insight. You know, the early chapters of Murder of Quality in particular gives us a really good kind of overview of Smiley, but we never get anything in the authorial voice, you know, like what he's saying in that letter to Guinness. And it's really fascinating. Like, it should be published as an introduction to a future edition of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, I feel, you know, now that it's been published at all. And it's great having those. And there's several letters to Guinness that contain more bits like that too. And then letters about Guinness later on, where he says later on that Oldman, he thought, embodied Smiley more as he envisioned him than Guinness ever did, but that still he couldn't get past Guinness because he just owned the role so much. And there's numerous letters to Guinness and about Guinness that really just, it's clear that he did kind of Smiley, you know, whether it was Le Carré's perfect vision of him or not, he couldn't get him out of his head.
Related to that, there's just some really fun stuff that he writes about what we saw to Guinness, right? Because he's like talking about things that he didn't like about the miniseries as well, which I thought was fascinating. You know, he's kind of criticizing some of the stuff they did in a letter to him, right? What do you think of that?
No, that was really interesting, because it's sort of taking this, well, that was them and not us, you know, like, you were amazing, but I didn't like this or that. And he does it again. That actually becomes sort of a recurring thing for him with actors in his thing, because he had a letter to Hugh Laurie later on where he said, in a class of its own, lucid chapter by chapter, tense internally and externally, the action well-paced, all of it rising to skillfully engineered crescendo that ties up all the ends, except perhaps the question of how Pine is going to explain that little matter of $300 million and his current account to the Inland Revenue. and not a weak performance anywhere, just stunningly acted. He's raving and praising it, and then particularly Hugh Laurie. And then he comes around and he has some gripes, a few, which I've passed to Simon, but I don't want to mark your card before you see it and before you see it and form gripes of your own. You know, like even when he sort of like has this recurring thing of he'll write to actors praising their role, praising their work, but still having gripes about the material.
Yeah, well, and it plays to, like, what was it? You know, where he talks about how great Florence Pugh was in Little Drummer Girl, even though he didn't like the rest of the production and stuff like that, right? You know, so he's very good at that.
Yeah, and I listening, you know, I read and listened to it, going back and forth, listening to the audiobook, I really wanted to know her feelings about that letter, you know, like, because she's reading the narrative parts of that. Oh, but also, while I'm on that letter to Hugh Laurie, it's interesting because we were just talking about the Night Manager sequel. To Laurie, he says, see what you think. Sequel? Along the lines we discussed, if you're still drawn, I am, because Roper in that context strikes me as a dramatic goldmine, and Laurie and Roper as now constituted as a perfect match. So it's clear that at one point he was considering a Roper-focused sequel, whereas what we know about the new version that they're doing now is that it won't have Roper in it. So, I that makes me think that maybe they're proceeding with what they were going to do that was not along his lines of a sequel, but who knows?
If we're going to stay on the Night Manager, we get the revelation that as he was writing the book, he was imagining Daniel Day-Lewis and Julia Roberts as the leads in that when he was writing it, which, wow, I mean, could you imagine Julia Roberts as the leading lady in that movie?
Well, sort of at that time, because again, he was writing it decades before the TV version that we know
was made.
So, I could sort of see. I mean, it's a stretch, but I can see the Pretty Woman, Julia Roberts, sort of in that role.
Daniel Day-Lewis, could you see him as
Pine? I mean, I couldn't see him actually accepting the role, but yeah, I could envision him in it for sure. But, you know, over the years that's in development, and that one really, you know, all the movies that don't happen irk him. It's clear in the letters, especially when he's writing to John Calley at Sony, who was a good friend apparently until he felt that Sony bungled the release of The Tailor of Panama, and then those letters stop. So it seems like another friendship that just ended over a business thing. You know, he's very frustrated by the movies that don't happen, but Night Manager seems more than any, because I get the feeling he wrote that one to be a movie almost, you know, even when he's talking about the covers, as we discussed before, and I don't want to gun on it, but I want to show the glamour of the world, the Rolls Royce and the beach and, you know, like that. It seems like he was thinking along movie lines, and I think he thought that it should have been a slam dunk getting that turned into a movie, and it annoyed him how long it took. So he's actually expresses hope over each iteration, even when Brad Pitt is attached at one point to star as Pine, which of course is very different. Day-Lewis is much more closer to the British Pine of the book than Brad Pitt is, but Le Carre is willing to go with that to get it made. You know, he's like, you can tell in the letter that talks about it that he's sort of talking himself into it. I think he was happy with anybody who he thought could get it made. But it's interesting to get who he imagined to begin with.
As he's working on this movie with Sidney Pollack, there's some fun. There's a really nice letter where he goes in again, like into the characters, and tries to kind of explore who they are, and particularly Jonathan Pine. He says about him, "In Jonathan, there is some kind of terrible wall around his life that he is trying to scale. He espouses convention, dresses for it, behaves for it. We meet him when he is a servant of luxury, yet he loathes luxury as he loathes waste and wasted lives. He is at heart a monk, a mountain climber, a solitary soldier, a watcher, and a person of determined solitude and self-sufficiency, even though he longs to connect." Just all of these kind of things he goes into, like really diving into the characters, which is fun to get his sense of those from the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, it's like that Guinness letter. He boils it down for actors really well. And I think that might come from his own acting experience. You know, I mean, he knows from doing those productions back in school, but also still doing the audio recordings and stuff. He knows what actors need to know about the characters, and he's good at condensing it. And he also wrote, interestingly, in a letter to Rafe Fiennes, who he stayed in touch with after the Constant Gardener, he had wrote that the night manager would be perfect for him at one point, I assume for the Roper role. And that was when Brad Pitt was still attached as Pine. He said, and Brad Pitt has exhumed the night manager, which would have been perfect for you, still would be, from the contractual morass it was in. And the last I heard, it would be due on Labor Day. Obviously, that version never happened, but he's working the room too. You know, like he's talking to Rafe Fiennes, so he's going to throw in a pitch. Like, you'd be great in my, in this. Especially since the Fiennes movie had won Oscars. And as we talked about before, he was, though he may have rejected literary awards, he clearly had a, was under the spell of the Oscar, you know, so I can see why he would want Fiennes in that.
ABC, always be closing. Yeah. As a writer, that's what you do. Yeah.
But one more thing with Guinness is, I mean, this is jumping ahead chronologically, but he stays in touch with him his whole life, essentially, and is writing to him long after he's done playing Smiley. There's this little postscript in between letters where it's actually, well, he wrote a letter to Janet Berger saying Alec died in one hospital while Marula was in another, his wife. What a sadness. And I just can't help but think of how ultimately he and Jane died in very similar circumstances. They were in separate wings of the same hospital, as I understand, but because of COVID couldn't be in touch. And it's just, that's very poignant to me because he found it poignant for Alec Guinness and his wife to have been in separate hospitals and commented on what a sadness. And then just for that same thing to happen to him. And I think despite what we've talked about of his infidelities, I think it's very clear in his letters how much he did love Jane.
Yeah.
The two aren't mutually exclusive things. And they were clearly very, very close. And it just really seems so sad that he had specifically commented on that particular sadness and then ended up going the same way. It really made me feel sad.
Well, and Tim, his son, who edited this collection of letters, obviously would have been very aware of that. And I would imagine was part of probably why that letter was chosen to be included.
Yeah.
And something that he was obviously aware
of.
Yeah,
probably.
Moving on to something a little lighter, there is a wonderful letter to a fan, which obviously we're fans, so I've got to highlight the fan letters, yeah. Right? And there's this one on page 366 to J.E.C., and I'm going to not do this name justice, Kootenbauer from the Netherlands, where he talks about Tinker Tailor and, you know, like, how does he balance these wedges on top of the door and then drawing the door slowly towards him and giving it a last hard pull as he closes it. You know, how he closes the door and keeps these little bits in there without Peter Gillum. Like, how does Peter get in them in his room without disturbing his secret way of knowing somebody's gotten in there? And I thought that was pretty fun, right?
Yeah, it's weird because I don't know quite how you could predict which critiques he would take umbrage at and which he would like. But if it was like a mechanical critique like that of how do the physics of that work, he seems to love those. Because there's another instance too of a fan writing with some specific question. I forget now which letter that was, but and again he's like, well, nobody noticed that before, and you're very observant to have done so. But
he enjoys putting out the no prize, right? I mean, if you're gonna go to the Marvel Comics version of things, like, he's a big no prize fan.
Was the letter that you just read, was that the one where he says, I could have changed that in later editions, but I decided not to leave it how it was? Or was that the other one?
No.
Okay.
I think that was that was the other one. But he talks about accepting the house prize for attentive proofreading, which I enclose, you know, like, so like very much the no prize kind of version of Lacariism. Yeah.
Also, he really does seem to have loved fan letters. It makes me really regret never writing to him. Did you ever write to him?
I didn't. I thought about it, but I didn't. I was also like, gosh, you know, like at this point, I'm writing to like somebody in their 80s. It just felt like, you know, I don't know if I should be doing that at this point. Like, doesn't he? I want him to write more books. I don't want him writing to me.
Yeah, that said, I mean, I know that there are, I know some other fans who actually established some correspondence with him.
Oh, for sure.
Late in his life.
No, it's great. I only have myself to kick on that one. I should have just done it,
too.
But it's, you know,
I regret
but
it.
But it's great that he did do that and reach out to these folks and have that correspondence, which
but
is wonderful.
But then again, while he likes the fan letters, he also, there's a pile of Nutter letters that in S, and it's out for him, you know, and then end up in their own drawer.
Yep.
And, you know, with crazy fans like us, you have to worry, you know, that we might have ended up in, you know, say the wrong thing, see a little too obsessive, you might end up in another drawer instead.
That's true. We might have been in the crazy pile immediately. Oh, this is the podcaster. Yeah. Nope. Not responding. Agreed. Although, yeah, I did like the no prize aspect of things there, which was really fun in that one.
Yes.
And there's another one where he talks about playing it fast and loose with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, which I think is kind of what you were talking about, right? Where he's kind of going on about some of the inaccuracies there. Right,
yeah.
I love that. And yeah, you're right. He did talk about, you know, fixing stuff in later editions, but just decided to keep it the same. And I think that plays into some of the stuff we see later with A Legacy of Spies, right? Where he really enjoys just playing it fast and loose with stuff that he's set up before.
Yeah. And he says, yeah, that he didn't reread The Spy Who Came In From the Cold for that. And it really answers a lot of our questions when we did a podcast years ago about Legacy of Spies. And we had all those nitpicks like, oh, that's why, because he didn't even bother to go back and reread. And he seems kind of amused that fans like us will be flummoxed by some of that. Like, what's the actual quote?
He says, "And it amuses me very much that out of the many millions of people who have now read the book, only a distinguished handful, of whom you are one, have discovered the shifting grounds on which it was built." You know, kind of not acknowledging like, yeah, okay, maybe this isn't quite right, but guess what? You're like one of like two people who have reached out to complain about it. So maybe just not worry about
right.
it. That's I do like he does have some fun with his readers, which I appreciate. You know, it reminds me of though, like, you know, because he did reply to all of these people that would reach out to him. And it rings back to this, you know, story. I don't know if it's true or not, but Margaret Mitchell, who wrote Gone with the Wind, right? She would reply to every person that would, you know, send her a letter. And she would, she did that so much that like it kept her from writing another novel. Like she literally wrote no more novels because she was so busy responding to the letters of other people
wow.
that would write to her about Gone with the Wind. So, you know, I just appreciate that Le Carre kept writing, even though he was getting probably a significant amount of fan mail there.
Right. Well, I imagine it was probably also. He talks about his routine, his writing routine a lot in the letters to guests who are going to stay there. Like, I write early in the morning, so you are not going to see me. You know, you have in a guest house, there's a kitchen. You can make your own breakfast. You know, don't use the pool when Jan and I are going to. But other than that, you're welcome to use the pool. And yeah, don't expect to see me until the afternoon. So he clearly has a routine. It would not surprise me at all if responding to those letters was a part of that routine. Because writers do get, like, you need, there's a certain degree of procrastination that I think is part of the writing process. Once you get past it, that's when you get to never writing that other novel, like poor Margaret Mitchell. You know, like, you don't want the procrastination to become the main thing, but there's something, part of your brain is working on your next thing mm-hmm. while you're procrastinating. And I suspect responding to fan letters was a great way to procrastinate a little bit. And probably his brain was doing double time, you know, writing those, but also thinking about the next like little knot in his story that he's working on.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that came up was in a letter to his brother, where he talks about Our Game, and he talks about his brother reading it. You know, he's responding to him about that. But it brought up something that like makes me, you know, I want to get some sort of person who is deeply immersed in German literature as well as John le Carré literature to come on the podcast, because he talks about Our Game and he says, "Good of you to read Our Game, which was an odd book. Not bad, but too driven by its unacknowledged German models of the education of the senses. It is at least credited, though, with predicting the outbreak of hostilities in Chechnya and appeared almost to the day that as war broke out." So, like, I love that. Like, that's been said by him in other places. Things that people haven't realized about his writing that have come from German literature specifically, and that's influenced his writing in a way that has never really been acknowledged.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know. But then it seems that usually when he talks about it, it's in books that aren't entirely successful to him. Because in a later letter, he calls Our Game a bum novel, which I was surprised by, because he doesn't denigrate many of his own novels in this. But and to me, I actually really like Our Game. I find it one of his better novels of that era. And then the other book that he very much compared to German, what was the terminology you just used?
German models of the education of the senses.
Oh, yes.
Which I don't even understand what the hell he's saying there. I'm going to be dumb Jeff right here. I don't know what he's saying.
Well, I think it goes with what we were talking about on the Silverview podcast. And who was that author who was such an influence on that one?
Oh, yes. Who wrote Walking of the Area there.
Which seems to be focused on the senses. What he's talking about is probably that same school of German writing. And it seems like when it takes over too much, because that one, of course, he ended up abandoning. And in these letters, as far as he was concerned, not publishing. We all know that things turned out differently after he passed away, and it did come out. But yeah, so I think he feels that when he sort of goes too far down the rabbit hole of his German influences, he doesn't necessarily come out with the most successful books. But yeah, just as a reader not familiar with those German works, I disagree, because I really do like Our Game, and I like Silverview quite a bit within the limitations of what it is. It would be very interesting to sort of to get a German scholar who knows these works and interpret the works of John le Carré through that prism.
Yeah, and it was Sebald's Rings of Saturn, which was kind of referenced in that and obviously played a factor in Silverview.
Right.
But I agree. I think, you know, there's something else, like he read and was so interested in German writing. And so there is some factor of that that plays into his writing as well. And so I do hope to talk to somebody about that sometime. So if you're a listener and you know a lot about that and want to talk to me, I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email at lecarrecast@gmail.com. But I just want to reiterate what you said. Our Game isn't a bad novel. He was really trying something new in that one, especially because that's the first novel where he really leans into the first person. He's trying something new with kind of an unreliable narrator. I love that novel. And so to hear him ding it so much really does kind of feel bad, because I think it's one of his underrated novels.
Yeah, and it's also one of the ones where he's still dealing with kind of middle-aged protagonists as he's aging, you know, like starting with Barley Blair, we get these kind of aging protagonists up to a point, and then he sort of dials it back with Pine and with some of the later heroes and writes about characters younger than himself again. But I felt like there was a great authenticity to the narrator in Our Game in terms of being at that point in his life from a writer than at that point in his life.
All right, Matthew, I've run through my list. Matthew, one last thing before I turn it over to you for any last comments here. I've got to say, at first, the honorable schoolboy had the tentative Ludlum-esque title of The China Target. How much would you have loved if that had been the title of The Honorable Schoolboy as a Ludlum fan?
I am a Ludlum fan, but I don't necessarily want my Ludlum and my le Carré to mix.
You don't want to cross the streams.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that would have been a great le Carré title. I think The Honorable Schoolboy is a much more, especially with that O-U-R British spelling, is a much better le Carré. But that said, I mean, The China Target, it's not one of his worst title suggestions.
That's true.
That is certainly discussed much in the book, The China Target. And, you know, there's some of those other titles, not quite as hot.
The Carcass of the Lion at the China Target, I'd take that any day over The Carcass of the Lion for the spy who came in for the
Yeah. Cult, so. Although, had it been called The China Target, we might have gotten a movie of it by now.
Agreed. I'm not going to fight you on that one. All right. Anything else that you wanted to kind of make sure we touched on here before we close out our epic 3-episode look at A Private Spy?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been doing all these episodes over a period of time now, and I just can't quite remember what we've covered and not. So there's certainly some interesting things about Silverview. I just found that basically the letters answer the questions that we raised about it when we had our episode discussing Silverview. We wondered why he had chosen not to publish it, and we speculated on a few things. I forget which of his sons did the afterword, Nick, right? The afterword to it. And he speculated that maybe it was because he portrayed the Secret Service in a worse light than any of his other books, and he didn't want it to come out while he was alive. But, I mean, he must not have read this letter, since it was a different son working on putting the books together, the letters together into a book, because he actually says in one of these letters exactly why he put Silverview in the drawer. When he's writing to Tom Stoppard, he says, "Finished the novel, read it, wasn't convinced, wasn't moved, revisited too many old themes, and decided to dump it. Now I feel much better, just a bit surprised. My agent, who hasn't read it, nobody but my sons have, is surprised too. Is this age, freedom, just the misapplication of energy in 2 years? Actually, I think the last, as I am writing away happily at something else." So, I mean, I think that really is it. Revisited too many old themes, you know, like which we talked about, which makes it perfect for what it was eventually used for, as a posthumous one extra, you know, a gift to fans. There's one more that we've got. Yeah. And we talked about why we liked it very much, as a kind of greatest hits, revisiting things. But those same things would have made it not work publishing it while he was alive. You know, I can absolutely see why he put it in the drawer for that reason, because it's true. He didn't raise new themes. Instead, he was dealing again with themes that he had dealt with before, in most cases more successfully, but he was doing it very well still, because he was still at the top of his game, even at late in his life. You know, like, he never lost it, as we've discussed. So to me, that's the answer. You know, we were all looking for that answer when we were talking about Silverview, of why did he not choose to publish it at the time. And I think we have it now. Like, there's really no need for further speculation. It wasn't hurting the feelings of people in the Secret Service who he knew. I don't think it was even about hurting Jane's feelings with the character who has cancer in that book. I think it was really just what he said, that it just it didn't do new things. And I think he made the right call putting it in the drawer at that time. I also think his sons made the right call publishing it when they did, after he'd passed away. I think it ultimately became the perfect drawer book.
Yeah.
And then a great gift to fans after the fact. One other thing I want to touch on that we talked about in one of the other episodes but couldn't find the reference was writing to Mary Mount at Viking about the paper quality of his books. Mary Mount was Le Carre's publisher at Viking Penguin from 2009 until he died. After Le Carre expressed concern about the pages of his Viking hardbacks aging too quickly, Mount wrote that a different paper would be used without wood pulp in the future and offered to send him a sample. Viking published Claire Tomalin's Dickens biography using the paper plan for A Delicate Truth. And he writes to her, "Dear Mary, fascinating and thank you. No need to send a copy of Claire T's Dickens, as I have one and will immediately scurry off to examine it in a new light. Thanks again for taking all the trouble." As collectors, because we're not just fans, we're also collectors of books, and particularly of John le Carré books, it's really interesting to note that he cared about the physical appearance of his books, because we certainly do as collectors, you know, and for him to think about what, you know, the browned pages, and it's true that there's a period of his hardcovers from the 90s and early 2000s, as collectors, you're acutely aware they have a problem with the browning of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I like that he was thinking about that, you know, and it was really, he's, you know, I'm sure part of it is pride, but part of it seems to also be looking out for his readers who buy something and pay a lot for a hardcover, it shouldn't turn brown like a paperback. It'll be interesting to see if time is as good to the non-wood pulp books as she assures him it will be, hopefully. But yeah, there was a period where British publishers in particular were using these pages very prone to browning. They just feel like shoddier books from that era, you know?
Yeah.
It's also around the time that they were, well, I guess in England they'd been using glue binding for a while, but in America they were still usually doing sewn binding, and the British ones tended to be glued, and the combination of the glued binding with the brittle browning pages just is a much less satisfying book to handle and read, especially in an era when ebooks were the threat of taking over. Like, he still valued the physical book.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that.
I appreciate his looking out for us as readers, but I also love that image of him scurrying off to his bookshelves,
yes,
right? It reminds me of when I spoke to the founder of Gillam Coffee, and he talks about how Le Carre wrote him this letter that he looked for a little drummer girl book, but instead pulled his copy of The Pigeon Tunnel off the shelf and inscribed that to him to send off to him. Just love the idea of him pulling these books off of his shelves and looking through them, right?
Yeah.
As a reader, as somebody who does that themselves, that's just very fun.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And I also, speaking of his shelves, I love that he had two full collections of P.G. Woodhouse. That's
yes.
That comes out in there, that there were two full sets in the house, and also that was the one book he brought with him to the hospital in his final days, yeah, was a P.G. Woodhouse collection. And we discussed, of course, Woodhouse in another episode, but in terms of his shelves and imagining that, wow, I would just love to see that catalog. You know, I hope that also ends up at the Bodleian, because I'm sure a lot of his actual book collection ended up there. I hope there's a catalog of what was on his shelves. That would be fascinating to know.
Well, there's this place, Library Thing. .com that has the catalogs of famous writers. They like have their like book collections that they have there. So you can look at like, oh, this writer, and they list out the books that they had in their bookshelf.
Is he on there?
I don't know that he is. I hope at some point, though, that would be wonderful to see there. So, you know,
yeah,
shout out to the Library Thing people that put that request out there, because I think that would be really neat to see.
And as for the scurrying to the shelf, a Dickens biography, of course, he had the Dickens biography. You know, like, what a perfect like choice that turned out to be, because I mean, as we've discussed before, that definitely seems like one of his major influences is Dickens. A Perfect Spy is as close to a modern Dickens novel as I can think of, you know, like, and he didn't disappoint me that he had already bought the Dickens biography, you know.
All right, Matthew, anything else that you wanted to make sure we touched on before we close the book on A Private Spy?
No, I just want to say that it's a massive 712-page book that we're talking about closing, and I recommend it to all fans of his. It's not a book that has to be read cover to cover. You could easily just sort of dip in and out and read various letters, go by the index, find the people you're interested in. But I actually do recommend reading it cover to cover, because it becomes another autobiography, and in many ways a more revealing one than the very guarded Pigeon Tunnel, where he's telling us just the story that he wants us to hear. I feel like we got a much truer picture of the person through his letters. And I would say just don't write this book off as just, oh, it's just a collection of letters, I'm not interested. It's got excellent writing. You know, I mean, he is the writer that he is, whether he's writing prose for a novel or writing a letter to a colleague, and they're well-written, they're insightful, and they really give you a window into the man, David Cornwall, that we never got from any other biographical source.
I completely agree, and I've said this many times now, but if you want to learn about John le Carré and you don't want to read the Sisman biography for some crazy reason, I think this is a wonderful alternative. I really enjoyed reading it. I think you do get the sense of who this person was as much as you're going to. It was a wonderful read, very fun, and I can't help but recommend folks pick it up. All right, we're going to stop here. Thank you for joining us for our epic three-parter, Matthew. Oh my gosh, three parts. Three, I don't know how many hours we're in here now. Probably more than they're going to hear. I'm going to edit this down, but you know, 3 hours worth of A Private Spy. could you ever imagine?
I don't envy your editing task that lies ahead. But yeah, it's been a pleasure discussing them, and thank you for having me.
If folks want to find you, what's the best way for them to do that?
00section, that's 00section.blogspot.com. My blog, not terribly frequently updated these days, but quite the deep archive of Le Carre-related articles on there that you should search through.
Search for the Smiley Files. They're a very in-depth look at all of the Smiley stuff that Le Carre did. It's really great. On Matthew's website, I recommend that. And I'll have links to that and all the various things discussed today in the show notes and on the episode page at lecarrecast.com. I know I say this every time, but if you enjoy the show, please do leave a review. It will help other people who are looking for Le Carre stuff look at the podcast and say, hey, this is the one we're going to listen to. This Le Carre-focused podcast, not all other dozen Le Carre podcasts that are out there, this is the one we're going to listen to. So leave a review in whatever favorite podcast app you've got. It will help other folks find the show. Or if you just want to drop me a comment, tell me what we did right or wrong, feel free to go to the website or on Twitter at Le Carre Cast. Until next time, thanks for listening. Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.